Yeah, we need them.
All right, so we still are waiting for our presenter, Peter.
We'll wait until my clock says noontime.
Perfect.
The official. All right. Great. It's being 12 o'clock. I'll call the special meeting of the Missile Services Committee of September 13th to order. And first item is to adopt the minutes of the July 26th meeting. So could I have a motion in a second, please?
So moved, Lori Spielman.
Thank you, Lori. Is there a second?
I'll second, Peter. Grace.
Thanks, Grace. All righty. Is there any discussion or suggested changes to the minutes as presented? All right. Don't see anyone or hear anyone. So all those in favor of adopting the July 26 minutes as presented, please raise your hand or say aye.
Aye.
All right. Anyone opposed or abstaining? Okay, great. Thank you very much. This point, if there's any public comment, please raise your hand. Kim, are you, or Pauline, are you seeing anyone for public comment?
I am not.
Great. All right. We will close public comment at this point. And do we have both presenters, Pauline?
I think we have the one, Peter, who's up first, and then the other will be joining us shortly, and that's how we structured it.
Okay,
great. We actually have Stuart in the room as well. He's the second presenter.
All right, so what I'd like to do, just so that our presenters know who their audience is, do a quick introduction, and I won't be able to. So if we could start, I'm not sure if I'm looking to Kim. Kim, if you could just ask folks to introduce themselves, that way there we can get everybody and all the presenters know who we are and what communities we're representing.
Absolutely. Do you want to start first, Peter, and then we can do
absolutely. So welcome, Peter Souza. I'm the town manager in Windsor, and the chair of the Municipal Services Committee. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Lori?
Lori Spielman, First Selectman for Town of Ellington.
Grace?
Hi, Paul, good to see you. I'm Grace Tiezzi, I'm the Assistant Town Manager from Avon.
Scott?
Scott Colby, Assistant Town Manager of Windsor.
Mayor Moran?
Tony Moran, Mayor of Mansfield.
On Elsa, sir. Oh, you're muted, John.
John Elsesser, Town Manager of Coventry.
Wendy.
Hi, I'm Wendy Maxitis, First Selectman, Town of Simsbury.
Thank you. Stanley?
Hey everyone, or afternoon, Stanley Hawthorne, Town Manager, Bloomfield.
Mr. Crisati.
Yep, Bob Crisati, Mayor of Enfield.
Rick Ledwith.
Good afternoon, everyone. Rick Ledwith, Town Manager from West Hartford.
Brandon.
Hi, Brandon Robertson, Town Manager, Avon.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Rupert.
Good afternoon.
Would you like to introduce yourself quickly?
Oh, Jim Rupert, Town Administrator, Town of Bolton.
Thank you. And Larry?
Larry Nyland, Vice Chairman, Glassbury Town Council.
Super. And then I will go ahead. Ken Bona, Program Manager here with CROG.
Matt Hart, Executive Director, CROG.
Elizabeth Sanderson, the BIL Coordinator at CROG.
Kyle Scheel, Principal Planner, CROG.
We've got Pauline and Cheryl online from CROG.
Great.
And then I think we got everyone. If I could just, real quick, Peter, I believe Stuart is on, McCutcheon.
Yes, ma'am. I'm on Stuart McCutcheon Dynamics Consulting Group.
Yes, and if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to put you in the waiting room, or if you want to log back in around 20 after 12 with Mary Ellen, that would be wonderful.
Okay. So you said 20 after 12?
That would be fantastic. Thank you, Stuart.
All right. We'll see you then.
Okay.
Great. So thank you very much for taking the time to introduce yourselves. Today, we're going to change the order up because we do have some guests. So we'll do have the presentation on the topic related to fire and emergency medical services studies. And this is a topic that had been raised several months ago as a number of the our communities had been considering undergoing or undertaking rather a fire EMS study of some fashion. A few communities have completed such a study. And so we thought it would be helpful just to get a couple different perspectives on what it takes to get a study done, what these studies may involve. Obviously, each of our communities are unique, so we'd have individual scope of services that we develop. But we thought we'd be able to, from information sharing and, if you will, kind of level set you know, what fire and EMS studies may entail. Not sure, Matt, if you had anything else to add, or do we just want to go right into hearing from our first presenter, Mr. Bishop?
Just a couple of additional comments, Peter. Thank you very much. And good afternoon, everyone. It's great to see you. Hope you had a wonderful, wonderful summer. So we did ask the two firms who are presenting to us today. First, we've got Paul Bishop from the Center for Governmental Research. And then we have the firm of Dynamics Consulting Group with Mr. McCutcheon and Ms. Harper. We asked them really to just talk about the realm of what's possible with respect to a fire and EMS study. Just a general overview. Much of it can be customizable based on a community's needs and interests. And then we also asked them to touch on, and this is a very important component, once the study's complete, once you have that study in your hands, the importance of having resources in place to actually implement the recommendations. Because the last thing you want is to have a completed study you spent a lot of time and money on, and you don't have the resources to implement. So with that, Peter, we'd like to turn to Paul Bishop, and he's our first presenter, can talk a little bit about their experience.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matt, and welcome, Paul.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Bishop. I'm a principal for the Center for Governmental Research, where I a private nonprofit research firm headquartered in Rochester, New York. We do work all throughout the Northeast and actually to the Great Lakes and a little bit down in the middle Atlantic states. Personally, I've been working in EMS and doing studies related to EMS and the fire service been in EMS for 30 years, and I've been working as a consultant with different organizations for the last 10. And I know we have kind of a time crunch, so I'm gonna jump right into the presentation here. One thing to know is the state of EMS and fire operations. They're often a hidden public service. Nobody thinks about them. No one really wants to think about them until there's that dramatic need. There's that car accident and it's ties up rush hour. Or there's the pedestrian struck, or there's a house fire, And when it goes well, no one really thinks twice about it. And if there's something wrong, if it took a long time for them to get there, or there were more patients than they could immediately handle, that's when it becomes really that public concern. And that's often the sentinel event that triggers someone wanting to say, hey, we need to look into this a little bit more. One thing to know is fires have been declining for decades. As there's better engineering, there's better fire protection systems inside public buildings or commercial structures. There's not nearly the number of fires that there used to be. On the flip side, EMS calls have been increasing for that same time frame. We have an aging population. Hospitals are not keeping people as long. They're getting them back out into the community, and they're often sicker than they used to be. So we're seeing an increase in the call volume on the EMS side, a decline in the call volume on the fire side. Fire departments are most often, not exclusively, but most often government-based and tax-funded. And even if they're an independent organization, but they have a contract with the town or a contract with the fire district, they're still getting that money from the government. They're not expected to necessarily perform a service in order to get it. To get the money they need to provide the service. You do have some organizations that do a lot of fundraising. Maybe it's that chicken barbecue or the fund drive letter, something along those lines to help their funding. EMS service, it is all over the map. It is everything from fully commercial services that are fee for service to fully funded fire department based ambulances that are really, they may bill for service, but they also get a considerable revenue stream from the government to make it work. The costs for all these services are escalating more rapidly than inflation. And that was before we've had this jump in inflation for the last couple of years. So the costs for making the service work are going up. We'll get into some of that reason in a minute. The big challenges that the services are facing: qualified employees are hard to find and keep. This is a challenge when you're paying for people, and it's even more of a challenge when you have volunteers. Volunteerism across the country is trending down. When you don't have the volunteer Boy Scout leader, you don't have the volunteer soccer coach, it doesn't hit the headlines. If you don't have enough volunteers showing up to staff the fire department, that's a big deal. When you don't have enough volunteers to staff your ambulance, that's a big deal. That hits the headlines. And that's something you really need to consider. We talk about the cost rising. It is everything from the equipment that you need to go into a burning building. We want people to do it safely. A generation ago, they weren't wearing the kind of suits that they are today when they go into a hazardous environment. So now we're paying $3,000 to outfit each individual to make sure it's a properly fitted suit. And oh, they have a life of only 10 years. Before they're not usable in a hazardous environment anymore. And then things like just helping the stretchers. The automatic lifting stretcher is kind of the requirement today. It extends the life of the employee, which is fabulous, but they also cost, depending on which model you go with, seven or $8,000 up to $35,000 a piece to lift the patient up and into the ambulance. A back saver on one end, but a big expense on the other. The working environment itself is becoming more hazardous. This is particularly on the fire side. When we do have a fire, it is there's more toxic gases in the building than there were before. When wood burns, it burns relatively cleanly. But now if you have a house catches fire, there's all sorts of plastics involved, all sorts of petroleum products that get burning. And it creates these toxic gases. But also on the EMS side, it is a hazardous environment. I have spent much of my last 2.5 years working in EMS wearing a mask that I never used to. Infectious diseases are more prevalent, and we're all treating a patient like they're a potential source of COVID or another disease. The training requirements have really, really gone up in the last handful of years. Or last decade, I should say. And this has led to firefighters and EMS providers that are more educated. They're better trained to do it, but it takes longer to do it. And instead of a volunteer giving up, a Saturday or two for a couple of months and then being okay, you can go into a fire, They're now spending two nights a week and some Saturdays for 6 months to become qualified as a firefighter to go into a hazardous environment. In the EMS classes, an EMT used to spend about 120 hours in the classroom. Now they're spending about 180 before they're allowed to get out on the streets. And the regulations, and importantly, the public expectations have both gone up. As you're having people who grew up in a city or some dense suburban environment where they may have had a paid staff, a paid fire department, they move out into a community that's heavily based by volunteerism, they have some different expectations. One, they don't have the expectation of volunteering to ensure that there's the service. And two, they have the expectation when you call 911, you're going to get that 4 or 5 minute response, not that 10 or 12 minute response. What's the role of local government? Sometimes you're actually the provider of the service. The people who are on the vehicles are drawing the paycheck from the local government. And other times you're the contractor. You're the one who's negotiating with the company, whether it's a fire company or an ambulance, whether for profit or not. You're negotiating with them to establish the service levels, making sure that your community is getting what you need. So elected officials and managers need a basic understanding of operations. Much like no one's expecting you to go down to the sewer plant and be able to operate that facility or drive the plow on a snowy day, no one's asking you to get on the tip of a fire engine or know how to operate the defibrillator, but you need to begin to understand what the priorities are for these organizations, what their needs are, understand what their state-of-the-art current operations are and what the future is. All providers should be held accountable, especially if they receive tax dollars. You should be able to call up the leadership and the fire department or the ambulance and say, how are you doing? How's the service? How are you providing that for our community? What are your responses like? Are you getting enough people? Are you getting there in a timely manner? Do you have the right equipment to make it work? And this needs to be an ongoing conversation. You shouldn't be introducing yourself to the fire chief at the big event. You should know them well before that. And, you know, the organization, the role of government may have expertise that is lacking in the public safety realm. So if you've been a volunteer firefighter for 10 or 15 years and you worked your way up the ranks and you're now the fire chief, but you've never learned how to do a bid spec, or you've never really understood what the human resources policies are about sexual harassment in the workplace. These are things that the town government or the city government can provide to that fire service because they don't have that in-house expertise. You get into the leadership roles by learning how to be a good firefighter or learning how to be an EMS provider. You don't necessarily pick up these other skills. And in particular, we're seeing that financial planning, getting ready for what the 10 or 15 year cycle is for those financial needs is something that we're not finding in fire service or EMS. What are the benefits of an outside perspective? When you have an outsider or consultant coming into the organization, they have that fresh set of eyes. They also have a real good understanding of what is the professional state of the art. What is the industry expecting? What are different relevant regulations and guidelines that you should be following and help identify what's going on? Are you meeting those guidelines, those recommendations, or is it something that there's a gap in? A typical study comes in and takes a look at what the current situation is, identifies the options that you might need to make the changes to improve the service or to plan for the future or anticipate those needs. And then they pull it together and make a final report, whether it's a written document or a public presentation or a combination of those. When you take a look at how's the service today, these are some of the characteristics you want to find out about. Right? You need to understand what's going on with the staffing or the people. Look at what are their staffing levels, what are their shifts like. On the EMS side, how many ambulances are on duty? Are they running a scramble crew where people are sitting at home waiting for the call and getting down to the base? Or are they waiting at the base for the call to come in? What's your level of training on both fire and EMS? Are you meeting what the standards are that are established by different professional organizations or the state to be able to say, this is what you need to do? Do you have enough people that are meeting that standard? Being able to go into a hazardous environment is often called either a firefighter one level or an interior firefighter. You need to keep up on an annual basis to understand how to operate safely in that and prove that you can. What's going on with the volunteerism? And just knowing that they have an adequate number of volunteers on the books isn't enough. Are those volunteers showing up? You know, we'll often come in and work with an organization. They'll say, oh yeah, we've got, you know, 80 volunteers on the books. Well, how many of them have made more than 20% of the calls this year? And that number drops dramatically. And when you're looking at hiring, are you do you have a number of applicants knocking down to the door when you post a position, or are you really scraping it to find the candidates that you need? EMS in particular across the country is having a difficult time getting qualified candidates to apply for jobs. And if you're to talk with any of the large providers and ask, you know, how many openings do you have today, you just get a chuckle from the hiring manager. They would hire every EMT that walked in the door, and there's just not enough of them. Take a look at the equipment. Understand it, you know, what's the age of the equipment? There is a life cycle. There's a guideline that fire engines should be frontline for no more than 15 years, should be replaced to 20 years. The ladder truck should have a cycle of about 20 years. Ambulances, depending on how much they get used, they might only have a 5 or 6 year life cycle. And particularly as we're using more gasoline engines and fewer diesel engines in that industry. Do you have the right equipment for the town? You know, if you have a number of bigger buildings, do you have that ladder truck? If you have an expressway or an interstate running through your community, do you have the kind of rescue equipment or hazardous materials response equipment you might need for an incident in that area? And how are you handling that maintenance? Is that something that you're able to do in-house with your DPW staff, or is that something that you're always contracting out with? Do you have a good vendor? Are you making sure those pumps are working on a regular basis? Do you test the ladders? There's a lot of requirements to make sure that you're providing a safe environment for your workers, whether they're paid or volunteer. Taking a look at communication, you know, how's your 911 service operating, your radios, your data needs? These are all kind of your bread and butter operational characteristics that you need to know what's going on in these departments. And there's some metrics that we want to ask for. These are specific measures that you should be looking for on a regular basis, not just when you're taking the time to do a study, but understand what's your demand for service. How many times a day are you responding to a call? If you're a fire department, are those all, you know, fire calls? What's the nature of them? Are you getting a lot of false alarms? Are you going on EMS calls that maybe you're not needed for? The types of calls, the locations, time on task. So that's the time from when the event occurs to when you get back in service. EMS, that's one thing that we're seeing across the industry. That's getting longer and longer. So it's not the time that it takes us to respond to the call or that we're transporting the patient, but turning them over at the hospital is getting, it's taking us longer to do. It's getting difficult to transition that care. And, you know, how long does it take you to get to the scene? What's your turnout time like? Particularly for volunteers, we want to know how long does it take to get that vehicle rolling? That all adds into that response time. Now, rapid response time isn't always necessary. If you're responding for that chirping smoke detector at 3 p.m, we're pretty all sure that it's because the battery's dying, you don't need to run lights and sirens to get over to that. Or if you're responding to somebody who's had a stomach ache for the last 3 weeks and they've just now decided it's time to go to the hospital, again, we don't need to use lights and sirens to get over there. On the fire department, there's certain metrics we also want to look at that are specific to them. One is the ISO rating, or the Insurance Services Organization rating. They're an independent organization that are used by the different underwriters that comes in and looks at every fire department in the country and asks them some standard questions and asks them to prove their level of service. They do a rating between 1 and 10. 1 is the best. 10 is you don't have a fire department. Most career departments are finding themselves in that 3 and 2 range, and volunteer departments, a good one is going to be a 3 or 4, and the average one is going to be a 5 or a 6. And sixes are kind of a little sketchy with their ability to provide the service. And what how that ISO rating gets used is to decide what the insurance rate is going to be. More so on commercial structures than residential, but it gets considered. What are the number of personnel to respond? A recent study showed that during the day, volunteer fire departments get half as many responders as they get in the evening and overnight. And they may only, and that's a challenge. So if they're not getting enough people during the day, how are they accommodating that? Are they getting mutual aid or automatic aid from the neighbors to make sure that that's happening? When you're talking EMS, you want to find out that level of care. Is it EMT only? Are you getting paramedics when you need them? What are the treatments they provide? What's that transport ratio? Only about 60 to 70% of the calls that an ambulance is sent to actually get transported to the hospital. And so they're not able to bill if they're relying on their bills for service. There's 30 or 40% of their calls that they can't bill for service because no one, you know, most insurance companies don't pay for the non-transport. What's that payer mix? How many are getting commercial service, commercial insurance, which pays pretty close to what it costs to provide the service? Medicare getting closer, but really doesn't cover the cost of providing an ambulance. And very often Medicaid is a substantially lower rate than what the cost is to provide the service. And finally, what's your community opinion of the organizations? Do they feel like they're doing a good job? So when we go to look at the options, we're trying to identify them. We create them separately for every community that we're working with. Identify, it's based on the needs identified in the baseline. We're trying to bring the services into alignment with industry guidelines. There's no one specific standard that we can apply because, you know, for example, there is no simple response time formula that we really try and talk to what the community needs are. Consider the community's ability to invest. Mm. Can you work with your neighbors for a better solution? Is this something that, you know, we're doing capital planning. Does every organization need a ladder truck, which now costs almost $2 million? Or is your community in such a place where you can share it with a neighbor? And when we're looking at, want to consider what's the relative cost, benefit, and then return of investment on those different options. And, you know, finally, we want to consider who's the right audience for the report. Is this something that we're going to share with the general public, or is this really focused on elected leaders and the leaders of the organizations? The last part is when we're trying to do the changes, right? Prioritization is key, and you want to work throughout the project and say, okay, these are the things that we know from the beginning that we're going to need to focus on. You know, as an example, maybe we're trying to lay out a 10-year plan. So we're going to focus really on what our priorities are over the next 10 years. We know we have other things, but they're really 12, 13 years down the road. The state of the art might change. Our tax base is going to shift. So we don't need to worry about those as much as these are the things we know we need to accomplish in the next 10 years. Consider life and safety first. You know, if you have a hazardous work environment that you need to improve, or you need to get the kind of equipment to make your people safer, those should be your higher priorities. What's that community impact that we're going to see? And sometimes your policies, changes to policies, can be impactful as a purchase. If you're changing the way you're doing something, you might be able to save some money or provide that better response. I always encourage folks to look for easy wins to build momentum, right? If there's something that we can come away with, you know, just to get people to buy into the process and say, all right, you know, this is our 10-year plan, and we found these 3 or 4 things that we're able to do right out of the gate. Sometimes it's some policy changes, sometimes it's some smaller expenses, but it gets people excited about the process and gets the community to say, yeah, we're committed to this. We're going to go and we're going to make these investments. You want to establish these regular check-ins and review of the progress. So you have the report, and that's kind of, you know, your day one. When is you're going to have these check-ins, whether it's a quarterly or semi-annual basis. You don't want to wait just till when the budget is happening. So sometimes the needs get identified and then, oh, there's a grant that comes through. So you're able to make your purchases faster. And speaking of grants, you want to shop around for them. There's a lot that end up being available. The federal government is giving out a lot of money to fire departments through their different grants, a little bit less to EMS, but it's available. Always look for that best value. And this goes back to that purchasing. Fire departments, they don't get a pass on whether or not it's the right item. You want to make sure if they tell you, oh, we need a 110-foot ladder, do we really, or can we get away with a 100-foot ladder or an 85-foot ladder? Is that something that works in our community? And really kind of question them, because you can save some substantial money there and really still provide the good service, but being able to save some money in the long run. So that is my presentation. I've got time for questions. I know you have somebody else ready to jump in as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. It's a great overview. And I open it up to questions that members of the committee may have. Just jump right on in, pretty informal here. Any questions, comments? Lori.
I have a question. Right now we have paid people for our EMS and our chief is a volunteer. We have quite a few volunteers. Obviously same problem as everybody else. But my problem is having a chief who is not really affiliated with the town to oversee paid people. It's been a problem for the last 6-7 years. I think our fire department eventually is going to go paid, but there's no way I want the chief to oversee these paid people. It just doesn't work out very well. Anybody else have problems like this?
This is not a rare problem where you're getting in a combination organization where you have the leadership that's volunteer and the frontline providers are career. When you say 8 providers, they work in some kind of shift work. So you have 2 or 3 on duty at a time. Is that how it's structured?
Yes.
Okay. Sometimes you need that frontline, just designating somebody to be responsible for that shift, whether it's a senior EMT, and they're just responsible for making sure that those tasks are getting done, and having that chain of command for them to report to. And you can have what's often referred to as an administrative chain of command and an operational chain of command. Right? Your fire chief isn't going to want to give up on these people when there's there's the fire or the car accident, and he needs them to follow his direction. When it comes to some of these day-to-day tasks or making sure the payroll is done or the chores are done at the station, they can report to somebody else for those kind of day-to-day things if there's a different administrator or different person inside the town government.
One question I do have, as far as if we start getting paid people into our firehouse, is there any towns that actually charge a little bit for going to a fire?
The only reimbursement that I'm aware of that you can get, there's 2 avenues for that. One is if you're doing inspections or excessive false alarm responses where there's some fines in the community, is one area. And another is there's a process where you can seek reimbursement for your response to motor vehicle accidents, particularly if you have to spend some time out there cleaning up fluid spills and things like that. You can seek reimbursement from the car insurance companies. But I'm not aware of a situation where people get billed for a response to a call.
Thank you.
Any other folks have questions or comments for Paul?
Just one quick comment. Paul, I noticed you didn't say anything about the fact when you were talking about gear that Many fire departments now are trying to purchase two sets of gear for their interior firefighters, with regard to cancer safety.
I don't know if you noticed, I think I took two breaths in 20 minutes trying to get through a cover a lot. You're right. That is a challenge, particularly if you have a organization where you're responding to a lot of calls, the ability to have one set of gear to get cleaned while the other's not, while you're able to wear the other. Departments handle that in different ways. And it is something that you have to be concerned about. Some departments will just have a library of common sizes that you can borrow from while your gear is getting cleaned. Is another potential solution for that.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Anyone else before we jump in? I will note to Lori's question, other parts of the country do have fee structures for fire response and reimbursement. It can be a little bit all across the board, but I am aware of some other states and regions that have done that. And I'll just put out there, anybody in the vicinity of Windsor that is looking to avoid the buying of a washer for their fire gear, Windsor has some availability to potentially use the existing facilities that we have in our new fire headquarters. So I'll put that out there for folks that are in the vicinity of Windsor. Without asking my fire chief, but that's all right. So anybody else have any questions for Paul? John El Salsa.
Yes, hi. We've seen a growing trend of fire administrators that are non-firefighters, maybe retired firefighters, to take care of the administrative duties from budgeting to staffing to inspections to just getting stuff purchased and bought. Are you seeing that nationally, or is this just a Connecticut issue?
I am seeing it in a couple of other areas where I'm doing the study. And sometimes those administrators for a volunteer department are allowed to stop being an administrator to help with a response during the day as well. It depends on who their employer is, how that structure works. But yes, having that person who's able to handle that administrative burden, anything that you can do to keep your volunteers happy and engaged and keep them around, is going to allow you to push off the adding of career staff a little bit longer. And if hiring someone to help with that administrative work, helps that. That's a good step.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Paul. We appreciate you sharing your insights and experience. We will be, I'm sure many of us will be talking on next steps. And so thank you very much. And I guess at this point, we may move on to having some conversation with Mary Ellen and Stuart from Dynamic Consulting.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity. Have a good afternoon.
Great. All right, so Kim, is Mary Ellen and Paul both signed on?
Yes, they are here.
Great. They're joining the audio right now.
And Stuart, yeah, Mary Ellen and Stuart.
Hello, this is Mary Ellen. Can you hear me?
We can, Mary Ellen. So we've got a pretty good group here from across the CROG geographic area. So we're going to turn it right over to you. We have probably about 15 to 20 minutes between presentation and discussion, Mary Ellen. So there you are. So we'll... Turn it right over to you.
So can you give Stuart the presenter? He's going to run the PowerPoint for us.
Sure. You find him. I just made you co-host. 50-50 chance, and I was wrong. Let's see. There you are. Okay. Okay, you both have the co-host ability.
Right, let me see if I can.
No pressure, Stuart, please don't mess it up. There you go.
Can you all see my screen?
We can, thank you.
All right, well, thank you all so much for giving us the opportunity to do this presentation today. I'm Stuart McCutcheon, and with me is Mary Ellen Harper, and we're going to give you all a presentation about the services we offer and some of the things that make us different from others. There we go. So the presentation overview, first we're going to do an introduction of Dynamics Consulting Group, an overview of the fire and EMS delivery metrics that we use, types of public safety consulting projects that are out there, some considerations when you're selecting a vendor for consulting to consider, and then finally answer any questions that you all might have. So first, I'll do an introduction of Dynamics. My name is Stuart McCutcheon. Did most of my time as a firefighter with Reedy Creek Fire, covers Disney and the west side of the Orange County Metro. And then from there, I was a municipal chief for 8.5 years, half of it in a combination system and half of it in a career system. Following that, I was picked up as a consultant, worked my way up to national director. And at about 2 years ago, Mary Ellen was director of operations and director of business intelligence. And we decided we just weren't happy with the way large national firms operate and offer services. So we started our own firm so we can do what we really want to do is help people solve the problems that they have and give policymakers feasible and reasonable options that are backed up by data so they can make the best decision for their community. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mary Ellen and she can introduce herself.
Hello, I'm Mary Ellen Harper. I'm the other half of Dynamics Consulting Group, and I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today. Connecticut is home. I was born and raised in Bloomfield. I joined Bloomfield Ambulance as a volunteer at age 16. I was a member of the Blue Hills Fire Department from age 16 to about 26 for 10 years. My dad was a volunteer fire chief there for many years. And when my husband and I got married, we actually lived in Blue Hill Station 4 on West Dudley Town Road for about 3 years while we built our house. So Connecticut's home. I did spend 20 years with the Town of Farmington Fire Department as the Director of Fire and Rescue Services running their combination fire department. I was also a member of both the West Haven Fire Department and the Colchester Fire Department. So 5 years ago, I left Connecticut, moved to Florida. It does not snow here. If you get a chance, I highly recommend it. And like Stuart said, I spent the first 3 years with the Florida State Fire College teaching the Florida Chief Officer Program, basically how to be a fire chief. And then after 3 years of that, I went over to a national consulting firm, worked my way up to the director of operations. And 2 years ago, Stuart and I started our own company.
All right, outstanding. So Dynamics Consulting Group, so really the thing that separates us and why we did what we did and started our own firm is that with, in particular, larger firms, and we were the managers, managing all these groups of program managers and different GIS and data and financial analysts, all these things, but it's all about volume. How quickly can you get as many projects cranked out as possible? And the problem is when you do it that way, you miss the people, politics, and personalities. And that's really what makes the world go around. And so if we don't account for that, then we can't make very good recommendations to you because we haven't considered some of the factors that are major players with any decision that you make. And so when we write these reports, they're for the fire department or EMS department or law enforcement, but we're not necessarily telling the department anything that they don't know so much as we're creating a document that policymakers and the general public can read it, understand what the issue is, why it's a problem, why something may need to be done about it, and then what the options are for that. So we stay away from jargon and lingo and things that would make it more like a technical document. But at the end of the day, it's also very helpful for the fire department because messages they need to convey, they're able to do so based on the material within the report. And so, finally, because we only substantially work on one project at a time, and that's so we can keep everything straight. It's, there's a lot of firms that, maybe I know that the other one, 15 to 25 at any given time was probably a normal number, but it's hard to focus and really give the personal touch that the project deserves. And so we you know, from the time we do the site visit until that final draft's in the client's hands, that's the only thing we're thinking about. And because of that, we're able to turn these projects over pretty rapidly compared to others. I'll let Mary Ellen introduce the staff.
So we are a dynamics consulting group, and we've stood up three separate divisions. We do fire, police, and EMS, and a little bit about our fire division.
Excuse me, Mary Ellen. We're somewhat confined for time, and so so if you could kind of just go move on a bit,
we
certainly. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Stuart.
Skipped ahead just a little bit. So we have a group, and there's some folks out there. This is just a sampling of some of the different metrics we do. This is from East Granby in particular. So one of the things, like if you look at this false alarms, 29%, for a volunteer fire department to have almost one third of their calls be calls they shouldn't be going on to begin with, it's indicating there's an issue there. And if you start taking volunteers and not utilizing their time properly, it can cause you some real participation problems. And so this example, one of the things we identified there, I'm speeding up just a little bit for the sake of y'all's time. And then here's some examples of others, population density, where are the people at, hotspot mapping, where are the incidents most densely concentrated, top right, 4 and 8 minute projected travel times, bottom left is your ISO engine company evaluation, then the next one, 5 mile, and then hydrants. And so we include in our projects the ISO piece because for several years, I worked directly with the director of community hazard mitigation with ISO. I would look at the data ISO had, the data the client had, and find the most bang for the buck. What are the things we can do to increase this ISO score at the lowest cost possible? Here's just some future demand projections. And then really, I think in particular in Connecticut with the volunteer systems and some of them going to combination or folks even being paid during the daytime, there's a lot of resources out there. And I think the opportunity, let's at least open the door to conversation about regionalization or how can neighbors help each other be more efficient and effective as opposed to everybody trying to stand up their own ladder trucks and all this stuff when we have neighbors all around us. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mary Ellen to discuss different projects we offer.
I'm going to run you through some of the major types of projects we do. The master plan is really the most all-encompassing. It's a 10 to 15-year plan that answers three basic questions. Where is the agency right now? Where does the agency need to go? And how does the agency get there? So that's where we benchmark the current performance, industry standards, best practices, and our experiences as consultants that have done this across the country. We will absolutely take the time to look at the data and show you what your data is showing you, but then we want to get in there and talk to your internal and your external stakeholders, really just to understand the environment, what's acceptable to your community, what they're looking for, what they're willing to pay for. We don't believe in benchmarking people to their neighbor next door, because even if you have the same number of firehouses and the same population, different communities have different levels of what's acceptable for what they're willing to pay for and what they expect for service. The agency evaluation is really a good option, especially if you've never done a study before. The master plan is the most comprehensive thing that is possibly done. The agency evaluation is almost like a report card. It's a very custom project. We'll come in and we'll look at the areas that are important to you, whether it's volunteer staffing, career staffing, consolidation, cooperative services, which is one that we did for West Haven, Connecticut. Station location evaluations, are your fire EMS police stations in the right place compared to where your call volume is? Deployment, are you sending the right number of people in the right ways that makes sense? And then concurrency studies, if you're expecting a major development to come into your community, we can look at historical data and project the anticipated income impact on your service delivery going forward. So that's a much smaller project. It's a lot quicker to complete, it's a lower cost, and it really lets you focus on what's important to you and get a snapshot of where your data is, what's good, what's bad, and then maybe, when you get all of the data where it needs to be, you could be prepared to go forward with that 10 to 15 year plan. I talk about the community risk assessment standards to cover. This is a pillar of accreditation for any of the career departments that are looking for accreditation. This is one of the three areas that they're going to need to do a master plan, a strategic plan, and a standard to cover. This is really a snapshot of the current performance of your emergency agency. What are we doing well? Where do we need to go? Where are the holes in our response coverage? And it really just gives you an idea of how to focus on that. It doesn't so much involve people, politics, personalities, volunteers. This is just, when the rubber meets the road, what kind of services can we deliver, how quickly and how consistently. And then there's the strategic plan. So the strategic plan is really a 3 to 5 year work plan. I would tell you the best way to do a strategic plan is to follow an agency evaluation or a master plan.
And the reason for that is when you do an agency evaluation or a master plan, you're getting our opinion when we look at national standards and best practices of what we think you should be doing. The reason the strategic plan is important is because that phase we bring all of your stakeholders in and say, okay, out of these 50 recommendations, what's important to our stakeholders? We can't do it all at once. Where do we want to start? What do we need to do first, second, third, and you get the buy-in. So everybody agrees on this is the direction we want to go. These are the things that we want to get done. And then we help facilitate very reasonable goals, objectives, timelines, who's going to be responsible for what, when, and where. This is not a to-do list for the town manager, or the fire chief, or the police chief. This is a, we are an organization. These are the things that we want to do, and this is how we're going to get it done. It can always be done as a standalone project. We could come in tomorrow and just do a standalone strategic plan. It's just important to understand that when you do that, you're going to be prioritizing what your stakeholders already view as the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. And I really believe that if you add that data analysis component to bring into that along with the perceptions of your stakeholders, that it's a much better product. Couple considerations real quick, you know, whether you're looking for a public safety consultant now or in the future, you always want to ask who's on your project team, especially with some of the larger companies. You know, they may have 15, 20, 25 consultants. Find out who's on your team and get to know them and find out if you have a level of comfort. It doesn't matter who works for the company. It matters who works for your project. You want to know how many people are going to be on your project. And this is something that, you know, we learned the hard way is, you know, many hands make light work, but too many chefs in the kitchen create issues too. So you don't necessarily want 15 people on your project, because if everybody's looking at one little part of your department or your community, they're not going to have a systemic view of it. You really want to have a small group of people that are all talking. They can absolutely have their specialties, but you want it small enough that the group sees the system as a whole and understands how all the little parts and pieces are going to fit together. The other thing is you want to talk about experience that's relevant to your organization. You know, if you're going to be a combination system, you want somebody that's got a background in volunteer and combination systems. If you're a metro urban department, you want somebody with that kind of background. Not all public safety agencies are created the same, so you really want to look for someone that's got a background and understanding of the type of system that you have and or are moving into going forward. And then ask for sample reports that's specifically written by the people that are going to be assigned to your project. Again, it doesn't do you any good if a company gives you a beautiful report written by people that haven't worked for them in 5 years. You want to know who's going to be working on your project and see their work. You know, Stuart hit on it with how many projects are they developing at the same time. You know, any project manager that's got projects 10, 12 stacked deep is really going to struggle to look at the details and what's important to you. It's really going to be, let's check it off, get it done, and move it on. So you want to just find out, you know, how committed are they and how invested are they going to be in your one project. Absolutely ask, you know, how many times does that consultant get a request to come back for a second project? That is a huge way to tell if a consultant did a good job making a client happy. I would tell you that we're averaging probably about 60% of our clients to call us back and ask us to come back and help them with their next project, their next issue, or just any issues that come up as they're walking through their data or things that go forward. You know, people joke about consultants and reports sitting on a desk and collecting dust, but I would absolutely tell you, ask whoever you're considering, you know, how many organizations have made significant changes following a project from a consultant that they did. You know, I look at some of the things we've done just in the last year. We did an EMS study out in Oklahoma where the Cherokee Nation just invested $48 million in overhauling their entire EMS system, a direct result of a project we did for them. Closer to home, Stuart and I had the opportunity to work with the Worcester Fire Department. They've had 20 line of duty deaths. Nine line of duty deaths in the last 20 years. And we've helped them substantially change the culture, the infrastructure, the chain of command, the organizational structure as a whole. So, you know, things along those lines. Even closer to home, you know, we look at West Haven, you know, when the state hired us to come in and look at whether there was a benefit in consolidating financially or operationally, we made some strong recommendations that have been implemented right there. So at the end of the day, I would just ask you to talk to the people that are going to be on your team, build a good relationship, and just make sure you have a good feel for them, because if you can't trust your consultant, you're not going to get the kind of project that you need to meet your needs.
So with that, that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have. I can see Pete talking, but I think he's on mute.
All right, sorry about that. And Mary Ellen and Stuart, thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence in pushing it along a little bit, because I did want to get to questions from our committee members. So I'm gonna open it up now to committee members. Any questions you may have for Mary Ellen or Stuart? Can you jump right in? I can't see everybody the way my screen's set up. So I do have a question, a little bit of a clarification. When you spoke of the community risk reduction, the standards of cover, is that looking at NFPA standards, Mary Ellen or Stuart? Yeah. What are some of those standards that you're looking at?
So in the standard of cover and the community risk assessment, there's two different ways that you can approach that project. If you're doing sole mission is CPSC accreditation, then there's a fairly rigid format that they want you to follow. And that's so they can check off that you did, you know, clicked all the boxes, everything you want to do. Both of them are going to be based off of NFPA standards. But another way to do that, because that SOC CRA can be a very technical document that's difficult to read, you can also accomplish all those benchmarks and have it in a much more public-facing document that's easier to understand. And we look at things like what's acceptable to your community, or you know, even generate recommendations out of it, and or it really anything in between. I've done them both ways, and I've done a couple offshoots, but I think the most important thing is understanding what does the client need and what's going to help them, and then give them the product that they're looking for, not just give them something standard out of a box.
Great. Thanks for that clarification. Other folks have questions? Matt.
Thank you, Peter. Mary Ellen and Stuart, Matt Hart from CROG, thank you so much for volunteering some of your time today. Mary Ellen, you and I have talked in the past about some of the challenges communities have when it comes to implementing the recommendations set out in a study. Can you talk a little bit about your experience there and any tips you might have? So once the community has the completed report, how they move forward.
Absolutely. And that's where that strategic plan really comes in. I would tell you that anybody that you don't involve in the implementation process is going to automatically just resent the project and everything along with it. So, you know, we work really hard when we do these strategic plans to bring the stakeholders in, both internal and external, whether it's community meetings, online surveys, meetings with the members. I like to collect both quantitative and qualitative data. So we do, you know, meetings and surveys so that we can have, you know, a combination of all of that. But when we do these meetings, we bring people in, we give them a chance to talk, ask questions, let them know that their opinion matters. But to me, the important part is we take pictures and have their names in it, because it's really hard for you to go forward and absolutely hate and object to a document when your face and your name are all over it and it shows that you were part of making it. So, you know, we work really hard during our one-day strategic planning session to really build champions. When we walk out of that room, everybody that was in the room should feel very comfortable with the direction we're going. They may not all have the exact same ideas, but there should be some buy-in on the big picture, and everybody going forward can explain why the goals are where they are, why we're moving in that direction, and be a champion of that outside of that plan.
Thank you.
Great. Mary Ellen, I may have misunderstood this, but is the community risk reduction, the standards of cover, could that be part and parcel of an agency evaluation, or are those two very distinct?
It can be any way you want. So, you know, there's a couple different versions out there. A community risk assessment is part of the community risk assessment standard of cover, and you absolutely have to do it in that order if you want accreditation. If you're not looking for accreditation, you can do anything you want. So I have communities that have come in and they've only wanted a community risk assessment with a community risk reduction plan. They didn't even want a standard to cover. They wanted to look at their data and find out what kind of issues are in their community. Are there drownings? Are people dying in car accidents? And they wanted to come up with, you know, community risk reduction plans based on that. I would recommend that you do a combination of the assessment with a standard to cover, because I think it's important to see where your calls are and make sure we're matching the number and types of resources you have to the demand in your community. But at the same time, that implementation plan, whether you call it a community risk reduction plan or strategic plan, you know, once we have this data, we know what's going on in your community, let's talk about what are we going to do about it. What are the goals and the objectives and the timelines? And do we need a car seat program? Do we need to teach kids to wear helmets on bikes? You know, every community is different, but I would go in and do it that way. But again, like Stuart said, it depends on, you know, what is your goal? Are you trying to reduce injuries? Are you trying to minimize the impact on volunteer fire departments for non-emergencies? Are you trying to get accredited? It can go any way you want. It's just a matter of how in-depth you need to be.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else have any questions for either one of our guests? I don't see anybody raising their hand. I would, for the members of the committee, I would recommend if you have a little bit of time, take a look at the East Granby study that Mary Ellen and Stuart just completed several months ago. I found it very interesting because they put forth some concept about regionalism or sub-regional partners. And I think it gives a good example of how I know, as I said earlier, really informing the public and the policymakers with a set of questions to consider. And so I didn't allow Stuart enough time to really look through some of those graphics that they did, but it's really based upon data. But I found it very interesting, not just because Windsor was part of the study area, but just gave an opportunity for us to kind of perhaps think in a broader perspective than our traditional, especially from a public safety perspective, our traditional, you know, town geographic boundaries. So,
East Granby's an interesting option there. They just put together a community committee of about 12 members of the community, the Board of Selectmen, the Board of Finance, and the Fire Department. And they are systematically working through that now and deciding, you know, how they're going to get support for the funding mechanisms, what their priorities are, and doing that. So I think that's one to watch. The other thing I'd just say, because I see a lot of people coming from combination and volunteer systems, is there's never a better time to evaluate your data than when things are not going bad. Let me say that again. If things are good, this is a good time to look at it. The thing about volunteer fire departments in particular is the people are passionate. They're doing this without a salary because they care a lot. Well, when they care a lot, sometimes the reactions are very passionate as well. So one of the things Stuart and I try really hard to do is to involve people on the front end, look at the data, and get a clear understanding of what is the actual performance of the fire department right now. It's a great time to have a conversation with the community. You know, is this acceptable? And then if it is, that's great, but let's look at the trends. Let's look at your volunteers' data, all data-driven, take the emotion out of it and say, okay, you know, if things change and the demand for service increases or the number of volunteers decreases, where is that level that we all believe we need to start making a change and start incrementally making things done? So we can get the buy-in on the front end and talk about, you know, what is that level of service and what do we need to do to sustain it? When things do change, it's not that somebody did something wrong or he's mad at her and there's no names attached to it. It's we've had a community decision. This is the level of service we want to offer. And we all agreed that when it fell below this, that we need to add resources and make those changes. So really and truly, you know, jump ahead of it, get into that, identify where you're at, have those conversations, and then keep watching that data because you're going to see these things incrementally change. They don't usually change overnight. So, you know, it's better to be prepared than to wait till there's a problem.
Southington was another good example of, you know, looking, they had a volunteer system that became combination. Now they're predominantly career, but there are trigger points that they need to start paying attention to because they're almost hitting a point where they're spending more money on a volunteer system that they're getting no bang for their buck out of. They're only retaining people for a few months at a shot, and it may be better served to put more effort into retaining the long-term volunteers that they have and using the other funds somewhere else. But we've at least broached the idea and given some data metrics where they can make those decisions and someone internal doesn't have to pose that question.
That survey's on, or that whole study's on their website as well, if anybody was interested in reading the Southington report.
Great. Thank you. All righty. Well, again, thank you, Mary Ellen and Stuart, for your time. We appreciate that. Very, very informative. And hopefully the committee members found that, and we're open to the committee members. If we want to continue this conversation at a future meeting, please let us know, let Pauline, myself, or Matt know, and we can kind of continue to provide this baseline of information. So great. Thank you very much, Mary Ellen and Stuart.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Y'all have a good day.
Thank you so much. Great. Great to see you.
All righty. So, we are just a few minutes past 1 o'clock. And so I'm going to ask Matt and staff to prioritize the key points in the staff reports, because there's a lot of activity happening. So I don't want to just skip over these. So Matt, I'll hand it over to you and you can play traffic cop.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter. And I will ask Pauline to lead off. Pauline, if you can give a very quick status report on RPIP waste management project, then I'll touch on building inspection and ask Elizabeth to do a very quick summary of where we are with the BIL. Pauline?
Yeah, so the RPIP projects, as you know, OPM asked us to get notifications from all the towns that have bargaining units, that the bargaining units have been notified regarding the RPIP applications. As a result of that, some of the towns have withdrawn, understandably, and we are retooling those RPIP applications for resubmittal because of the changes there.
and we'll be that'll be done probably by the end of this month or early October. With regards to the waste management project, that is well underway. Currently, the consultant is conducting the inventory of the region and doing a SWOT analysis, which I think is projected to be done in October, end of October timeframe.
Great. Anybody have any? Maybe we'll just take. If there are any questions on either one of those two for Pauline. All righty. Great. Thanks, Matt.
Yep. And those are both, you know, we'll continue to provide you updates on both of those initiatives. The waste management project, some of you are involved in on the steering committee. The building inspection program, recall, we've talked in the past about how many of our communities are struggling to find qualified people to fill in as assistant, deputy, building inspectors, officials, et cetera. So I really want to thank and credit Maria Capriola and the team from Simsbury. They have a deputy building official position in place right now. They're recruiting for that position, and that's a shared position. They had previously shared it with another town who was in a position to move up and hire a full-time employee. So CROG, we are negotiating. We've negotiated a MOU to share that building official with the town of Simsbury. And we will be able to deploy that person up to 50% of their time to any one of our towns that may have a need. For example, you may have a very busy period where you need some additional help, or you may have a vacancy where you need some help for an interim period. So really want to thank Simsbury. I think their board of selectmen will be reviewing it in the near future. And then we will be bringing the MOU to the policy board for its review and approval. Do you want me to pause there, Peter, or keep going?
You can keep going. I don't see anybody asking any questions on that particular item. So
great. Well, then let's talk about the bipartisan infrastructure law applications. I'm thrilled with the fact that we were able to hire Elizabeth Sanderson and Kyle Shield. Kyle had to leave for another meeting at 1 o'clock, but both of them have municipal experience coming from the CROG region, Elizabeth from the city of Hartford and Kyle from the town of Manchester. And I think we all know how significant of an opportunity we have here under the BIL, you know, over $6 billion coming to the state of Connecticut. And there will be some amount allocated for discretionary projects. The state has asked councils of governments across the state to play a lead role in terms of assisting our member towns with preparing competitive and quality applications. We know many, if not all of you, your staff are extremely busy, and these applications take a lot of time and effort to put together. So that's why we thought it was important to bring on some dedicated staff to assist with this five-year program. I'm going to ask Elizabeth to move really quickly through her presentation and focus on the State Streets for All program. And that application is due this week. And I really want to thank the town of Farmington. I don't think they're on the call today, but the town of Farmington for agreeing to be the lead applicant for this initial application. Elizabeth?
Sure. Thank you. Nice to meet you all. Pleasure to be here and part of the CROG team. Just to clarify, this is our definition page, BIL, also known as the IJA, Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So those terms are used interchangeably. And we have a couple of current funding opportunities on our website. So the next slide just kind of goes through the Bridge Investment Program, the Safe Streets for All, Enabling Middle Mile Broadband, Reconnecting Communities, Thriving Communities, and Railroad Crossing Elimination Program. We will be updating that list on our website as more opportunities become available. And as Matt mentioned, the Safe Streets for All, kind of in the weeds on this application this week, we are, in addition to the implementation grant that Chip, the town of Farmington, is leading, and we are helping to coordinate, we are also CROG applying for an action plan grant. So
that wraps everything up for that. We did include some additional slides that Kyle is working on, the reconnecting communities, which focuses on the disadvantaged communities within the CROG. And not all communities would be eligible for that, as well as the Thriving Communities Program, similar. So if anyone has any questions, but I'm happy to be here and as a resource, as opportunities become available and to work with you all in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, if I could just add a couple comments to that, Elizabeth. So we're gonna, every meeting of this committee will provide you with an update as to BIL opportunities and where we stand with respect to a particular application. We're doing the same thing at the Transportation Committee level and the Policy Board. And where a notice of funding opportunity, or NOFO, that's an important acronym for everyone to know. When a NOFO comes out, we're immediately reading it, reviewing it, working to digest it. Some of them, as Elizabeth mentioned, only a limited number of our towns are going to be eligible. So in that case, we will organize specific workshops for those towns that might be eligible for that particular application. Elizabeth, the Safe Streets for All, and the aggregate amount of that application we have coming in?
The implementation grant is $23 million. So
$23 million across five communities. You know, not bad for the initial round here. Again, it's going to be a five-year program. Really want to encourage all of our members to take advantage of the BIL opportunities. And we're here to support you with that work.
Thank you, Matt. Anybody have any questions? John, I see his hand come up.
Two quick things. On Friday's ACIR meeting, it appears that they're not aware that COGS are doing this work. Just letting you know. So somebody should probably talk to Brendan Sharkey, but he was trying to get different state agencies involved. And I kind of said that it was quite clear that the governors and his agencies are pushing things through COGS. So, let's not repeat that. Secondly, I also serve on the Connecticut Education Technology Commission, and CEN has submitted a very substantial middle mile application. So more on that, but they're feeling pretty positively on broadband issues. So stay tuned for that.
Thank you, John. I'll reach out to Mr. Sharkey.
Any other questions, comments on the staff reports? I had one quick question in Elizabeth. What is the timing on the Thriving Communities? Is that a short lead time or a longer lead time?
The Thriving Communities recently issued an RFI. So they have not released a NOFO yet for towns or COGS that would be eligible applicants. There is a pending NOFO for Thriving Communities that was sounded like it was more geared towards universities or other entities like that. But there's also the Reconnecting Communities, which has an upcoming application deadline in early October or mid-October, October 13th. So that
great. And you said there's recaps of these or links on CROG's website for everyone to dig into?
There's additional information on CROG's website related to many of the programs, but we may be able to share some information that Kyle put together from today's meeting.
Sure.
If that works.
Yeah, we can send, the handout should be available now, the PowerPoint can. Mm-hmm. But there is a dedicated section on our website for the BIL.
Yeah, that's just what I want everyone to know. They could go. That's where you guys will be putting stuff up in the interim between various meetings.
Yes. Yeah.
Great.
On the website, we're pushing out on social media, any number of things.
Right. Yep. It's right under the featured items as the top item there. So.
Great. Thanks. All righty. So. Great. Moving on to municipal information sharing. This is just an opportunity for folks to either pose a question that's been digging at you or want to share any information that might be good for the good of the order. So does anybody have any questions or information they'd like to share? Pauline, your hand's up, but I'm not sure if that's...
I just have one thing to note that we're collecting gasoline quantities, and that's a non-piggybacking, it's a no piggybacking bid. So make sure you submit your quantities because and these days you want to do that because gasoline prices are...
And are we talking about, within the week or what's that general timeline?
A couple weeks. You have until early October.
But great. Thank you. Better. All right. John?
Yep. Real quick. I just want to mention that we're continuing to work on that anaerobic digester project and opportunities there. I also think as we work on our legislative package for CROG, I think we need to absolutely push to get Medicaid reimbursement rates for ambulances increased. They're half of Medicare, and it's killing us. We can't afford to be their service providers when the state only pays 25% of our costs. And the final thing is, looking forward to an upcoming Crumbling Foundations meeting because it's been a while.
All righty, great. All right, does anybody else have any items under municipal information sharing? So, okay. I believe our next committee meeting is scheduled for the 18th of October. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be putting together that agenda. I believe we have a couple possibilities that are lined up for that. So, but as always, if you have items for future agenda items, please feel free to share those with me, Pauline, or Matt. That would be fantastic. I keep on saying Pauline. Pauline, if you're not the one you want this stuff, then just delegate. All right.
If I need to delegate, I just forward it. So it's good.
All right. Very good. I can't keep track of the roster there, Krog. I don't know what else it's a. So, all righty. Anything else for the good of the order? All right. If not, we will stand adjourned at 1:15. So thank you very much. Thanks. Take off.
Bye, everyone.
Take care.